So welcome everyone, welcome to our continued theme of birthing the heart, and tonight the talk is about applying the heart in practice. I want to keep us very pragmatic in this series, and if I go out on one talk, I want to bring us back to the ground and root system in the next. So tonight I want to make sure that we understand the way to apply what I'm speaking directly into our meditation, into our life, into the circumstances of our life. And so it'll be a down-to-earth, hopefully a down-to-earth talk. But before I do, I want to fly a little. And just by mentioning that, in meditation, in Buddhism, where the Buddha is pointing towards the freedom, the Buddha is pointing towards, both the heart and the mind have to be awakened. So they're not so separate as one might think, but for a point of explanation, they're helpful if we just separate them out a little. And the mind, of course, is the organ that provides the thinking, the thought, the abstract, the conceptualization of our life. And to awaken through the mind means that we really begin to see thoughts as being sort of outside the level of direct participation in life. They're what buffer us from the immediate experience of life. There's life, and then there's our thought about life, and we then rest on the thought as our living experience, when the thought is an abstract concept of that living experience. And so we have to kind of clear away a lot of that conceptualization in order for awakening to occur. And that requires a lot of time spending seeing that thoughts are not the reality we seek, that thoughts don't hold or even there aren't even a close proximity to what it is that we seek in life. And that immediacy of life is always distant when we are thinking about it. And then, of course, when thoughts are linked together in terms of our personal story, which is also a mental creation, we then become more remote. We become more remote because we keep bringing in our past in relationship to the present. And so we're not really living fully in the present because of the storyline that we're telling ourselves conceptually that has been built up through all the years and experiences we've had in our life, keep interfering with a more innocent relationship with reality as it's occurring. And all that storyline builds up into a narrative and a commentary where we're constantly have this little voice in our head telling us what's going on and who we are. And it's like we're hooked to that particular voice, that megaphone in some cases, a commentary in most cases, that is telling us what to do and how to do it and what everyone thinks about what we're doing and how we're doing it. And so it's a kind of a monitoring system that we have invested in over our life. And all of that has to be seen through in order for the mind to be quiet. If you believe in it, you're investing energy in it. And that will continue. When you stop believing in it, not because because you want to stop believing in it, but because you see that it isn't true, it doesn't hold the reality that you wish for yourself, you see that it works against you, your betterment, your definition, it works against everything. And so when you see that, I mean directly realize that, then you no longer invest energy into that particular facet of mind. And so when you pull out the energy from it, it gets quiet. It gets quiet. Quieter. But even the part that remains doesn't really intrude in the way that most of our thinking does currently. So that's a very important component of awakening. is learning the falseness, you might say, of mental speech, of the little voice in our head, isn't really directing us with our best, from our best interest. And so then there's the heart that needs to be awakened. And the heart is the confluence of all of the emotions and the sort of the emotional history we have and the emotional turbulence and all of the assumptions we have that have emotions at their base. All of the ways that we our self-definitions are ways that we believe ourselves to be less than or better than other people, and what we're sure other people are thinking about us emotionally when we do something wrong, and all of that, I can't, I shouldn't, I am not, I am a mistake, all of that emotional history, of course, is fed by the narrative of our thinking, supported through the narrative of our thinking, but it's the facet of our experience that probably holds us most firmly in its clutches, emotions, because they feel so personal, so real, and so intense at the same time. And so we have to work through the emotions. We have to bring some of our attention to our emotional life and see whether it's valid to offer and represent emotions, give them the life that we invested in them, to give them the truth that we've invested in them. And of course, as we settle within our emotional life, we see that, you know, they're no more reliable than the thoughts we think. Now, that's interesting, because some of us think if we tap into our emotional side, somehow we're sort of more intimately involved in life. But it's just as wrong to believe that as to believe your thoughts give you a clear depiction of life. Neither the emotions nor thoughts have a basis within reality. What they really are the influence of pasts of the past upon our present. They're how we have felt in similar situations. And tied to the narrative of that situation, they come forth and we believe them. And we believe in the narrative because the emotion seems so compelling. And so we invest a lot of energy in the emotions, and through the emotions we invest in the narrative, and then the whole thing sort of takes off with its own basis in reality. But when we look at it, when we quiet ourselves sufficiently and actually look at what it is that we're believing, there isn't much there to hold our attention. Not really. I mean, you have some words of the mind, and you have a feeling, an emotion that's arising within those words, supported by those words, which then the words further invest energy into the emotion and the emotion back into the words, and it becomes sort of a tornado of our life as we move from one situation to another. So to get a sense here that there is an exploration that's needed, we have to take ourselves on. We have to look at ourselves more objectively. We have to ask questions about our mind and our emotions that start and allow us to reveal the truth of what we've invested in them, what we believe them to be. And that's what we do on these Tuesday nights, is that we explore that. We explore different facets of our social, psychological, spiritual belief systems. Now, so it's important that you take your mind and your emotions with some intention to understand them, not just to operate from them, not just to believe them to be true. So now I want to move into a story of the Buddha and the Buddha's time, not forgetting what I just said, because I'll bring back the subject after this story. But there was a elderly man during the Buddha's time that was too infirm to go to the Buddha and ask questions, so he sent his young son, or his young grandson, to ask questions for him. And so the young man comes to the Buddha and he says, what do you teach? My grandfather wants to know what you teach. And the Buddha says, I teach a sila, I teach ethics. And so the young man runs back to his home and says to his grandfather, the Buddha teaches sila, he teaches ethics. And the grandfather says, well, is that all he teaches? And so the young man runs back to the Buddha and he says, sir, my grandfather would like to know if that's all you teach. You teach just ethical conduct. And the Buddha said, no, I teach samadhi, stability of mind. And so the young man nods his head and runs off. God knows how far he has to go. Goes back to his grandfather and says, he also teaches samadhi, what he calls stability of mind. And the grandfather says, oh, that's interesting. Go and see if he teaches anything else. So the young man runs a third time to the Buddha and says, do you teach anything else, sir? And he says, yes, I teach wisdom, panya, wisdom. And then the young boy runs off and says that to his grandfather, and his grandfather wants to know if that's the totality of what he teaches, and he sends him back a fourth time. So the young man comes back the fourth time and says, do you teach sila, panya, and samadhi, but do you teach anything else? And the Buddha said, no, that's all I teach. Okay? And then, thank God, the boy was probably perspiring at this point. Doesn't have to return again. Now, the reason I bring that story up is that I want to bring the preamble of this talk into that story. Because how do we explore the mind and heart from sila, panya, and samadhi, you see? That's the question. Now, most of us don't understand ethics. We understand ethics from our often Christian background or perhaps Jewish background. It's the Ten Commandments. But that's not what the Buddha is suggesting. He's suggesting, this is very important actually, and I think it's often missed. He's suggesting, I think, this is my interpretation, he's suggesting a sensitive way to live. He's suggesting a heartfelt encouragement to live. I mean, if you ever look at how we live, especially if you have no ethical ground on which to live, it's very base and kind of gross in the manner in which we disregard others for our own needs. And what ethical conduct does, sila, is it brings us into some degree of sensitivity with others so that we're considering the motions of actions and of body, speech, and mind while we are within our daily life, within our daily activities. And so it allows us to pause and to consider and to bring forth a more clear comprehension of what we're doing in that situation, which is what? Which is the heart coming out, meeting the situation without just our own, within our self indulgence, but actually considering how my actions might be affecting someone else, might be affecting the environment, might be affecting the situation or the culture at large. So really get a sense of how, when he talks about sila or ethical conduct, he really is bringing us into the heart. He's really encouraging a profound sense of awareness within life. You know, I mean, in the beginning, you do them because he says to do them, I guess. But very quickly, begin to see how they make awareness more applicable, more they touch with more subtlety the issues all around us. So Sila then begins to awaken us to the heart. Now, Panya. Panya is wisdom. So the Buddha said, secondly, to the boy, he said, I teach Panya, or wisdom. Now, wisdom is really the understanding of the differentiation between the present as it exists and what we bring to the present that is fabricated. So it's the difference between a fabricated and an unfabricated existence. And wisdom is meant to decipher the difference between those two. That's at its essence what it's about. So that we can begin to see the advantages of living in the present and the disadvantages of living within a fabricated, imagined, conceptual reality. And as we do that, we begin to establish a root, a groundedness in the present. And that groundedness is a very important attribute of spiritual practice. And of course, it is encouraged by the sila, by the subtlety of our awareness that has become more fluid, more nuanced. And all of that keeps us and allows us to be even more grounded within our bodies, within the earth, within ourselves. But there's the third. There is samadhi. Now, samadhi, we should understand, is to being sort of the firmness of mind, mental stability. Don't think of it as concentration. I'll get to that in just a minute. It's really mental stability, really oneness of mind, where you're just not in the waterfall of our thinking, where you can actually see something from a steady and persistent awareness. So that there's the opportunity is there for exploration, for seeing, for uncovering and investigating, from having a ground on which to discover what is occurring. So samadhi really helps us with the sort of the tumbling effect of our emotional life and the narrative, the ceaselessness of the narrative that just continues to move through us from the past. But with panya, the knowing of the difference between the present and the past, and with samadhi, which is the firmness of stance within the presence, and with sila, which is the nuanced awareness of being able to look with more subtlety at what is around us, those all together begin to allow us to see the false representation that the mind has given us throughout our whole life and begin to seek what is true and useful within that mental display. So we can see that intrinsic within the awakening of the mind and heart are these three, sila, samadhi, and panya, characteristics of the Dharma, which keep us very much moving in alignment with that awakening. Now tonight, I want to talk about an aspect of those three, especially relevant when we are in sitting meditation, but also true for general movement and activity outside of sitting. And that is bringing caring, right, or a more nuanced and subtle appreciation for what it is that we are seeing, coming through the sila of our willingness to ground ourselves in ethical conduct, with the attention that is essential for the samadhi, the stability of mind. There has to be a stability of attention. And unless those two are coupled together repeatedly, and even at the very beginning of when we practice, our practice will go astray very quickly. It's not good enough to just focus in attentively on an object, because it has no, I mean, a robber, a thief, is attentive about what he's doing, right? He probably has better concentration than I do. As he tries to finagle the safe or whatever he's doing. Okay? So attention alone has no ethical coordinate. It can be skillful or unskillful. And so if we invite a caring attention into what we see, now we invite a more comprehensive seeing into that attention, so that we are not just concerned with seeing the breath, but also concerned with caring attention in relationship to the breath. So when we are caring about the breath, you begin to notice a deepening sense of relaxation. That's the first thing. The attention itself doesn't carry that relaxation. The caring does. Because when you're tight and tense, the caring attention wonders why you're struggling. It wonders what you're doing. It asks pertinent questions of the tightness and tension that you're carrying with the breath. So a caring attention would be concerned about what we are bringing to the breath. And so then we begin to settle down and begin to relax through that caring, because we care about ourselves. We want ourselves to be relaxed and not tense. And then that opens up to actually what it is that's motivating us for even being on the breath. And that might show us motivations of achievement, needs for achievement, or whatever it might do, or a profound sense of self-discouragement, or doubt, or whatever it might show. And then we would start caring about that as a part of the transformation of ourselves. We would start caring about what we're bringing to the breath, as well as being on the breath. Right? So the caring aspect has a much wider wingspan than the narrow need to just see and be on the breath. And that's why over and over again, I will be stressing caring attention, not just attention, but caring attention. Now, you know, each one of these, you can feel the balance of these things in your practice. If the attention is just, if it's just rigid attention, then it's humorless and without any humanity. It's just kind of cold steel. And concentration can sometimes look like that. Concentration, which is our ability to hold our attention upon one thing and sustain it there, it can be. If your practice starts feeling dry, if it starts feeling mechanical, if it starts feeling rigid and just lifeless inside of you, then you realize there's too much effort on the mechanics of the practice, and we have to look over at the caring side of practice. Because the caring side of practice will bring in some fluidity, will bring in the humanity, it will bring in the heart, availability of the heart. And so it won't feel mechanical to you. Now, if you just focus in on the caring, which many of us like to do because it feels good to care, but you don't have sustained attention, then the caring gets kind of idealistic. It gets romanticized. It's just imaginary. And so, at that point, when you are always leaning into the caring thing you need to do, you need to have more focus. and more attention on what it is that you're doing, so that those two things are balanced. And you get a sense of when you need to do that, like when you're sitting, for instance, and you're just kind of drifting. You know, it feels good, and you feel, and it's sort of heartwarming, but you're in this kind of sine wave drift. You realize that there isn't enough attention. You're just afloat. It even has a technical name called sinking mind in the literature. And you realize that you're not really seeing anything. You're just kind of floating in the waters of life, not seeing anything. And so you need to fine-tune the dial of your attention so that you can see more exactly what is there. And then if you find yourself in a mechanical approach and you're not able to sort of bring any kind of warmth to your meditation, it might be a time to sort of step back, allow yourself access to a warmer, more fluid heart, getting a sense of the heart's availability, inclining the mind towards caring, and pausing your meditation and saying, okay, just let me incline the mind towards caring about what I'm seeing. And just giving yourself that permission can make a tremendous difference in how your practice moves forward. Sometimes metta, if you encourage metta in your meditation, that allows a kind of softening of the whole mental frame of reference and the whole body, and so that you can begin to relax and really appreciate yourself in a way that you can't from the mechanics of the practice. So there's the mechanics, and then there's the art of the practice. The art is the heart. The mechanics is just the technique. It's the how-to, right? So you have to be able to intuitively sense what you need within that how-to. Now here is one of the issues that whenever we incline our mind towards something that is not immediately at hand, like a kindness or a gentleness towards what I am seeing, or just a caring attention towards what I am seeing, oftentimes the opposite is what shows up. As a defense mechanism, the shadow starts looming larger than the perception of the kindness that you have asked or requested or inclined yourself towards. You can't be dissuaded by that. The mind brings forth often the opposite of what you think you deserve. In fact, if you look closely at what you think you deserve, it would quite likely be the shadow that is arising. You feel more, or we feel often feel more deserving of not the absence of love than we do the presence of love. We say, who am I to feel love? Who am I to really be self-kind and appreciative? Now, this is where I need the warrior in you to come out. The warrior in you needs to be activated here. You need to sit up and you say, you know, who am I not to love myself? Not who am I to love myself, but who am I not to love myself? It's time to make this change, this somewhat radical choice to move towards it, whether you believe it's deserving, you're deserving of it or not, and keep moving persistently towards it, not just give it one brief energetic spurt, but actually over time to be persistent with that. Because what you're then doing is establishing an intentionality for yourself going forward, that you're going to base your practice in the heart. Yes, you're going to have to understand the mind, but you're going to do it from the heart. So when the mind shows itself, you bring caring attention to what the mind is displaying, rather than rude or disruptive or annoying attention, or abrasive attention, or self-negating attention. You bring the heart along with you And the heart is the corrective factor in this. The heart is what actually changes the disposition of your relationship, not only to that particular experience, be it an emotion that's arising or an old memory that's occurring, but your disposition to yourself as well. Because after you go through this thing a few times and you've seen what's there and you brought caring attention to what is there, it all comes back in a very different outline than the original package when you undertook the practice to begin with. You start beginning to have a tender feeling towards yourself. And that's what's necessary here for this thing to take off. You aren't going to be able, or you aren't going to want to see anything that you don't care about. Why would you? You just want to get through it. That's a very different disposition. I want to get through my emotion rather than I want to see my emotion. I want to know what is there. So when we invite the heart as the inclination towards what is being seen, then you'll begin to understand what is being seen rather than just trying to do something with what's being seen so that it can diminish its influence on me. The attitude with which we approach the practice is essential in how the practice unfolds, either towards freedom or towards more self-recrimination. Get these basics down, you know, like a good sports team will practice the fundamentals. The reason I'm bringing this up is that even though you might have been practicing for 20 or more years, the fundamentals keep needing some repetitious practices, because the old latent tendencies for our self-destructive behaviors to arise have not gone away. They may be back there. They're quite likely back there in some resting tendency, but we're ready to spring out at the first opportunity. So this sense of wise caring. Now, why is it so hard for the heart to open? Why is it so hard? Why does it seem so difficult for this heart, for us to even want to claim any reference in relationship to ourselves about the heart, that we are kind people, that we are gentle, that we are walking in terms of more love? Why is that such a difficult expression for us to move in, to assume and to accept in ourselves? You see? You can see what's blocking it. Just by asking that question, you can see what's blocking our path in it. Well, one is that as I said, anytime you incline the heart towards love, the opposite arises. And what happens then is we try to escape the difficult that's arising in relationship to kindness, to the words gentleness or caring. And when we try to do that, of course, the heart is going to be completely missed. So what we have to learn is that no matter what arises in terms of an opposition for us to move forward with the heart, the influence of the heart needs to be brought up to whatever obstructs the heart. So we meet the obstructions of the heart with the heart. So what does that mean? It means that you meet the obstruction, the sense that you don't deserve, or that you're whatever obstruction you might have. Let's just say the feeling of being undeserving of this kindness. You meet that with caring attention. That's all. You've got a trump card in your hand every time. Whatever the opponent plays, you've got the trump card. Your hand is full of trump cards. You can't lose a deal if you use the right card. So it says, you don't deserve it. And you go, oh, wow, I don't deserve it. Let me feel that sense of undeserving. Let me appreciate what I've lived with all these years. You just won the hand. Next time it puts out another card. Maybe the Ace of Spades. I don't know what your Ace of Spades is, but I'm a mistake. It's like I can't do anything right. I'm forever whatever. Oh, I can't do anything right. Let me feel what that feels like. Let me sense that in myself. Let me look into that disposition of myself to feel like a mistake. You've just won the next hand. All right? But this is how we usually meet it. We usually meet it with agreement. Oh, God, of course I don't deserve it. My mother told me I didn't deserve it. Of course I don't deserve it. And then it won the hand. And every time it wins the hand, it gets stronger. It gets closer to winning you body and soul. So you can't let up. This is persistent, consistent and persistent meeting everything that your mind objects to in relationship to anything that's soft and tender about you. You have to meet it with that tenderness. And there's far too many people who just want to muscle their way through, never realizing that the attitude on the other side of that muscling is really self-abuse, self-degradation. Now, as the heart opens, because of the persistent way we move, guess what happens? It gets affected. It begins, you open it to in a particular way, and the pain of the world starts coming in. Now, that's the second reason that we turn away from the heart, because it's painful to open the heart. So let me just say straightforward, it is painful to open the heart. You start seeing the pain of the world. You start seeing the sorrow that's there. It's not the only thing you see, but it's the thing that often meets us at the door when we first open it. Let's go, God, I don't want to feel like this all the time. I'm going to go back and self-isolate myself. All right, so this is again where the warrior has to, you just say, okay, so this too I meet with caring attention. And if you, after a while, initially the sort of the tsunami wave of the sorrow of the world hits you, but after a while, the floodwaters recede, and it's okay. There's a lot of joy. There's a lot of other things besides just the sorrow of life. But you have to be willing to meet the sorrow of life too. And that can be done. And when you feel awash in it, you just say, oh, I need a break. It's too much. And because you're caring about yourself, you don't overextend yourself by staying too long. You mind your own needs. And so you say, oh, I've got to pull back from this. I have to take a break from whatever it is that you're doing, whatever caregiving chores you're... And you find your way back to some sort of healing, the samadhi of stability, the panya of knowing the difference between your history as it's coming through you and the reality of the relationship that's there at hand. And you just keep refreshing yourself back into the fundamentals. You see, no one's promising a life without being affected. If we move closer to life, meditation is not a detached, objective, distant view of life. We move closer. We are more affected. We have less interference between ourselves and the world, so the world gets in. And it gets in and it touches us. And the arising of the world in terms of pain arises within us the sense of compassion. That's compassion, by definition, is what occurs when the mind, the heart, touches suffering. And there's a lot of suffering out there. Right? So, but again, people think it's the whole thing. It's not the whole. There's a lot of delight, a lot of room to maneuver. Now, I want to give you another practical way to work with this in terms of whatever it is that might be your focus or your primary focus in meditation. Let's just say the breath. The mind's going to take you off repeatedly, as we all know. And when you realize that you've been off, watch what you say to yourself before you come back. And the best way to do that is to not try to come straight back, but come into your body and just relax a little bit. So you're dissipating whatever negative feeling you might have about your inability to stay on your breath. You're resting with it. You're letting that become where your attention rests, with carrying attention. You see what you carry with yourself every time, in your definition, you fail. Every time you fail, you're not on the breath, and the breath takes you away. That disposition of failure, that long past history of being a failure, comes up in most of us, and there it is. Now, we cannot disregard that. Because it's unpleasant, because you believe it to be true, is all the more reason to bring caring attention to it. And so when you're off the breath and you feel that, just let that be a sufficient meditation experience for you, is to actually feel that sense of self-dislike or feeling like a mistake or whatever it is that comes up in relationship to being off the breath. But first, let me say, you didn't leave the breath. It wasn't your intention. You were swept away. Everyone is. And when you wake up after having been swept away, you can't claim you did that either. That happens. You recognize that happened after it's happened. So where are you in all this? You're not the one that left the breath, and you're not the one that came back to it. But within that gap of experience, all kinds of trauma can pour through. And it's the trauma I want you to get a footing and a stability. Where does samadhi come from? It comes from the stability of seeing all of what the mind can offer us and not moving. It comes from that firmness of mind that knows itself so well that nothing moves it any longer. Oh, I know this. And everything is met with the tenderness of sila. Now why is attention so hard? I just explained why initiating or activating the heart is so hard. But why the attention side of the carrying attention, why is it so hard? Two reasons. One is, it's a practice. You've got to practice it. And I often tell people who are on or in the beginning class, you know, if you plotted the number of breaths that you're able to sustain your attention upon over time, you would see the graph be moving in a positive direction. Over a long period of time, not from one sitting to the next sitting. And so it's a practice. But there's another reason that is even more important. And that is because we aren't interested in paying attention. We want to drift. You know, we like to just kind of the floating feeling of being in a warm tub. You know, just like, you know, that's what drugs do for us, or alcohol. They keep us from having to pay attention. And so we have to look at our resistance to paying attention, our lack of interest in life. Isn't that amazing? This thing is around us all the time and we're not interested in it. It's the most amazing display you'll ever see, or could ever see, is what is available now. And it's like, oh, I'm not really interested in that. So it's like any obscuration, you know, you have to, interest builds upon itself. Which is what the homework is supposed to do. It's to give you interest in some of these obstructions. And when you start paying interested in why you're obstructing yourself, why we are doing it to ourselves, you get interested in why you're doing it to yourself. You get interested in, and you also see the possibility of moving through that into a different, with a different potential of yourself arising. You know, this is something I can do. I can see it, and I can let it go. Anyone can do that. And then you get real interested in your potential. And instead of having to hide somewhere, back behind the self-disgust that most of us have, this is like hitting a home run, you know, with bases loaded. You go, wow, I can do this. And those successes build upon themselves. And life becomes interesting for its own sake. For its own sake. Narayan and I were at this week-long that some of you here in the... And, you know, we were talking backstage. And I said, you know, one thing I don't feel anymore is boredom. She says, I never feel boredom either. I said, isn't that amazing? We never feel bored. Because I was giving a talk that night on boredom. And I had to figure out what it was. I don't feel it anymore. Because it's too interesting. You know, boredom is the lack of interest. And so at a certain threshold, and where there's nothing special about us, at a certain threshold, and I can't tell you when that threshold is or how long it's been that I've lived without it, it just isn't there. And so it will be for you as well. It gets to the threshold is reached in which life is interesting for its own sake, and it can't ever be offset. Right? So we've moved tonight, hopefully. You see what's resisting attention. You see what's resisting caring. You see and look at your practice and see which one, where you're leaning towards your caring and perhaps away from attention and just drifting, or towards your caring and away from towards your attention and away from your caring and feel mechanical and cold. And you intuitively think, okay, let me bring the caring back in, or let me bring the attention back in. Let me establish this samadhi that is at the basis of what the Buddha taught in the ethics, in the sila of the sensitivity, the gentleness of just being in line with life rather than opposed or cross-grained to it, and the wisdom that comes from that sensitivity and subtlety and stability, where you realize that now is very different than then. That those two, that the now holds then, but can be easily released. And you move forward in this caring attention. Thank you. So can we sit for just a minute or two? So I always ask everyone to stay the entire time we're here, the 2 hours, unless we have a bus to catch. You see, the caring and attention comes together in stillness. That's not mechanical, and it's wide open. Okay. Any questions or comments that anyone might have? Yes. Right.
More in like a, you know, the American like problem.
Right, right.
And that I think in and of itself is the same thing.
Yes, a very you that was insightful. She's saying that you know, that self deprecating background that we have, when we feel that in ourselves, we then sort of muster the only energy we can, which is to try harder and to force our way through that and to prove our attitude wrong by self-driving, which is really the confirmation of the belief in it, you see? Because if you weren't convinced in it, then you would go the opposite direction. It wouldn't even influence you to try harder. But because you believe it to be true, it forces you to try harder. So a different orientation to that is to turn to it and not to try harder to get over it, but simply allow it to coexist, to be present, to bring it out from behind where it's been unconscious and put it on your lap where it is now conscious and just let it sit there. It doesn't feel good. It feels like self-negation. You know, it feels doesn't feel good, but it's totally exposed now, and therefore it can't force us into an activity that reinforces it. That's the first thing. The second thing that the total exposure of it does when it's made conscious is that it can't sustain itself in its own logic because it's being seen. So remember those little Alka-Seltzer tablets in a glass of water? I'm going way back in time here. But there used to be, many years ago, they put an Alka-Seltzer type in a glass of water and it would land and it would start, you know, start disintegrating right there. So too, that sense of, that we believe so strongly, that sense of that assumption, that negative assumption, when it is just being seen with caring attention, can't sustain its own logic. And it starts falling apart in front of your own eyes. And at some point, it can't reestablish itself any longer. This is key. If we bring the right attitude to it from the beginning, it's very quickly dissipates. And it can't reform. It can't reform because we've seen through the very logic of how it was formed, the very thoughts that formed it. I can, I'm never. The feeling is that we are this way is proven. We prove through seeing it that it itself is not true. And once that is seen, that's the heart of it. Now the heart stops beating. And it can't form once the assumption has been seen through. So, again, it's going to come up. And this comes up in many, many different ways. In fact, if I were giving you a homework assignment that would be most revelatory, I would say, look at your core issue this week and see all the actions that are derived from it. And that's how often it comes up, and that's how often we reinforce it through our action. And I would say, instead of doing that, bring it out in front, put it on your lap, and don't act from it. So that's another way you can spend this next week if you so wish. Becoming more conscious, seeing something, not letting it drive itself. You see, if it drives itself into action, if you're revolting against it, if you're saying, I'm not going to believe that about myself, I'm going to show that, you're not understanding it at all. There's no caring about it, and it's going to be back there in a calcified form. And its shadow is going to be even more invested in it because all these antics and this fist pounding is reinforcing it. It's not doing anything to understand it. And the only way we're ever going to get through this stuff is to understand it. That's the Alka-Seltzer in the water. Somebody holding their hands up? Yes. Yes, sir.
Can you distinguish the difference between what you were just talking about, trying harder, and then what you were bringing up earlier with summing up your own warrior?
Okay. So when I, the trying harder, he's saying, what's the, is there a conflict between trying harder and then calling up the warrior? The warrior, when I call the warrior up, I'm calling up your resolve, okay? I'm not calling up your effort or your attention. I'm calling up, look, you've done this thing 1,000 times. You don't have to keep doing it. Now just stop doing it, all right? Right? I'm not going that way anymore. I'm not going to believe that anymore. I'm going to look at it instead of act from it. That's it may sound like I'm reacting to it, but I'm not. I've bottomed out from this particular action, from this particular belief, this assumption. And I've called myself this name, this I've had this feeling of being worthless my whole life. And I've just been acting from it. And that's all. I've done it. It hasn't helped me. It's just made me miserable. I'm going to look at it now. That's it. And that's the warrior. You see? The warrior now turns and looks right at it. That's the resolve. Not to react to it, but to see it. And not to keep playing out its theme. Okay, good. Thank you all. Next week we'll have a rousing discussion on this topic. Discussions are really important, for they integrate into the system. This is a cellular change we're going through. Cellular. If you think you can do this mentally, you're completely wrong. This is a bodily evolution. And from the bodily evolution, that requires realization. That requires action, right? Wise action, wise speech, wise mind, wise everything. It requires the whole system moving in accordance to this new way of seeing. Yes, sir. Yeah. How often it sets the motivation for your action. Don't try to change it. Just get a sense of the landscape. Okay? Get a sense of how compelling, how compulsive you are when that particular assumption arises. Okay, so announcements.